everybody, welcome back to the Memories of Dallas show, part of the Memories Inc. network of shows. This is a show where we talk about all the people, places, and things related to Big D, Dallas, Texas.
Today, I have a great interview for you. Executive Director of Memories, Inc., Paul Heckman, sits down with his friend, a very funny guy, and a musical talent as well. I am talking about comedian and impersonator, Alan Kay. This one is great.
Memories of Dallas is made possible through the generous support of Tooth Acres Pet Care Center. Tooth Acres is located in Carrollton, Texas at 1639 Parker Road. Tooth Acres Pet Care Center provides the finest indoor and outdoor boarding environment for your pet. With over 45 years of experience, the Clem family has created and maintained the highest level of excellence in the pet care industry. And they do it because they're pet owners too. For all your boarding needs, choose Tooth Acres. Tooth Acres offers cat and dog boarding as well as cremation and burial. You can reach them on the phone at 972-492-3711 or go to toothacres.com. And when you go, be sure to thank Lori Clem and the entire staff at Tooth Acres for supporting Memories of Dallas.
Hi, Alan. Paul Heckman here from Memories of Dallas.
Great to hear your voice, buddy. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. I believe since the 2019 Pop Festival. Hey, listen, can you tell me a little bit about growing up?
Yeah, I grew up in Kokomo, Indiana. It's a town about 50 miles north of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway where the 500 settled.
Right.
And very homogenous, you know, a lot of corn and a lot of beans, soybeans growing and tomatoes. It's kind of laid back. And compared to Dallas and Houston and places like that, it's just a blip.
Right. And, of course, this is not the the famous Kokomo in Florida that never actually existed, that the Beach Boys
sang. Right, correct. Not to be confused with any Beach Boy fantasies.
Okay. So tell me about growing up in Kokomo. You had to be a little bit of a redneck, a little bit of an army brat, all kind of rolled into one, huh?
It was kind of strange. I thought it was how everybody lived, of course, as a kid. And a couple of things. I went to a school that was a pretty tough school. I mean, there were fights every day, and it was lower to middle class families and blue collar, a lot of factories in my hometown. And I found out at a very young age that everybody's voice just interested me, accents, things like that. And I found out I could make kids laugh at school, so it was kind of cool because the eggheads and the bright kids liked me, and the redneck kids didn't mess with me a lot because I made them laugh too. So it was kind of a defense mechanism.
You're talking about the 1950s. Who were you probably imitating? 50s, early 60s.
Well, I was doing a lot of cartoon characters.
Oh, of course.
Doggy, Doggy, and Doggy, Daddy. And Foghorn Leghorn.
And Leghorn, yeah.
You know, things like that. And I was also imitating teachers and fellow students.
Oh, boy. Yeah. There goes your lunch money.
Right. Well, I think it really kicked in. I had an Aunt Moyne who lived in Indianapolis, and I used to, my folks used to put me on the Indianapolis Motor Bus, and I would ride the bus from Kokomo down to Indianapolis, and my Aunt Moyne and her daughter, Gloria, would pick me up at this huge bus terminal downtown Indianapolis. And they would take me to, like, the Shrine Circus and the Indiana State Fair and things like that. And one of the shows my Aunt Moyne took me to was Victor Borga. And it was at the Indianapolis State Fair Coliseum.
Uh-huh.
And I was watching the show, and at intermission, I looked at my Aunt Moyne and I said, I want to do that when I grow up. And I was probably, maybe third or fourth grade. And I said, I'd love to do that when I grow up. And she said, play piano? And I said, no, make people laugh. You know, I had a kind of a rough childhood. I had an abusive alcoholic stepfather, and my mother was kind of subservient and afraid of him. So he kind of ruled the house with a drunken iron fist.
Oh boy.
And I felt that the comedy was cathartic for me, and it got me by in school, and it got me by at home. And I used to lay on my back in the backyard and of my house and look up at the sky, and I would see planes coming into Grissom Air Force Base and planes going to Indianapolis Wercook Airport. And as a kid, I used to think, gee, I wonder where all those people are going, and maybe someday I'll have a job where I can fly on those airplanes and go different places. And as it turned out, I did just that.
Mm. Okay. So you, now, originally, weren't you thinking about going into the Air Force?
Well, I actually thought about going into the Navy, because my real father, not my stepfather, my real father was a Navy man.
I see.
And so when I became a teenager, I went and signed up to go into the Navy, and I took the tests and everything. And this was August of 69, and I had dropped out of high school. I didn't do my senior year. And things were bad at home, so I wanted to get out and get away. And I every week I'd go into the Navy recruiter and go, when am I going to leave? When am I going to leave? And he said to me, look, Alan, I've got all these guys signed up because they want to get in the Navy instead of be drafted. They don't want to go to the Army and go to Vietnam. They're hoping to get into aviation or you know, do something in the Navy. And he said, I've got my quota for the next 7 months ahead. I've never had this many guys ahead in my quotas. And he said, if there are any other branches that you can want to go to, you scored high on your test, we're all in the same game, I'll be glad to sign you over to another branch. Uh-huh. So I went down the hallway to the Air Force, because I went to McConaughey High School, and that was right near Bunker Hill Air Force Base, which is now Grissom Air Force Base.
Okay.
And he told me the same thing. He said, everybody wants to get in the Air Force because they don't want to be drafted. So down the hall was the Marine Corps recruiter, and the Army recruiter was across town. So I just walked into the Marine Corps recruiter, and I'll never forget it. It was a Tuesday morning, and I told him my situation. I said, you know, my home life is not great. I want to go, and I've been signed up now for quite a while. And he said, I'll be right back. And he went down the hall to the Navy guy and got my paperwork, and he came back, and he said, how soon do you want to leave? And I said, as soon as possible. And he said, I'll pick you up Thursday morning at 6 a.m.
And you probably
were headed to the Marine Corps.
You were probably heading right out to California to Camp Pendleton then, weren't you?
Absolutely. And when I got there, I got in a lot of trouble because I laughed a lot. And I got the nickname Smiley from Kokomo.
Oh, boy.
And every time he would be berating somebody or screaming at the top of his lungs or saying anything that I thought was humorous, he would shout out, Smiley, come on down here, because I know down the on the end of the line you're laughing your butt off. Come on down here. So after a day's training, the guys would put like four footlockers together and make a little impromptu stage, and I would do comedy and impressions for the guys in the haunted huts to kind of relieve the tension.
Oh my gosh! Of the DI, of course.
When I got out of the Marine Corps, I joined a band and sang, and I wasn't really a singer, but I was doing impressions, and I was doing an impression of a rock and roll singer, so the bands liked me, and I could sing,
uh-huh.
And was in bands for a while, and then when the bands broke up, I called one of the agents that booked the bands, and I said, you know, I need another band, and he said, well, anybody that's of your level has already got everybody they want, they don't want to split the money anymore, and he said, anybody I could put you with, some of my new groups, you're better than they are, and they're not making any money. And he said, but I need a comic to do a show, and if you know any comedians and you send them my way and I book them, I'll give you the commission so you can make a little money. So I called around to some guys. I didn't really know any comics. I knew some some magicians, and I knew some ventriloquists and things like that. And before I could get back to him, he called me and he said, "Hey, I remember that when you were in the band, when somebody broke a string or something, you know, had a little bit of time there, you would do impressions and comedy." And he said, "You only have to do, you know, two 20-minute shows, and they can be the same 20 minutes because we're going to clear the house." And I said, "Oh, great." And he said, "I'll pay you and give you my commission." And I said, "Oh, great." So, of course, back then, you know, there wasn't internet and cell phones. So what I did was I had a stopwatch, and I wrote down all the jokes that I'd heard my dad do and jokes that I'd heard and some impressions I did. And I stood in front of a full-length mirror, and I hit the stopwatch. And I went through this list of all these things I'd written down, and I hit the stopwatch and went, "Great. 10 minutes. What am I gonna do for 10 more minutes? Yeah, which was seemed like an eternity to me back then. And but I worked it out, and I did the show. And from then on, I started doing stand up comedy and impressions.
Now, let me ask you this: who were these shows for that you started on?
Well, the first one that he got me was opening for Albert King.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went down to Indianapolis to the show, and the thing was, it was mostly a black audience, and I was supposed to do two shows, one at 7:30 and one at 10:30, and do my 20 minutes. And right before I went on, the owner came back to me and he said, "Hey, Albert King's bus broke down, and they're waiting to get it fixed, so we're going to hold the show." So they held the show until 8 o'clock. Well, now the crowd's getting pretty rowdy. And he said, "You know, we're gonna hold it another 15 minutes, you know." And so now you're 45 minutes out, and they're going, "Albert, Albert, Albert." And he came backstage, and he said, "They're on their way," but he said, "It's going to take them a while." So he said, "I'll go ahead and pay you for this show, but you don't have to do it." And, Paul, I had the courage of my ignorance. I said, "Hey, I came down here to open the show. Now I'm gonna do the show. Go ahead and put me on. Announce me."
Oh, my God.
And he said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he looked at me like I was crazy. And as he was walking away, I thought, "I'm crazy. Why, you know?" And I went out there and introduced myself, and I said, "You know, unfortunately, Albert's bus has broke down, so that's why we've been waiting, and I'm gonna do some impressions and comedy for you and kind of lighten the mood here before Albert gets here." And I won him over, and everything turned out fine. So from then on, I started seeking the comedy.
And you didn't die. That's the best part.
I didn't die. That's a miracle. I mean, they were literally stomping their hands and feet. "Albert, Albert."
Okay. Now, if I remember correctly, this is about the time you got remarried or married for the first time, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, it was actually my second marriage, and I married a girl from Eaton, Ohio, and she worked at a bank in downtown Dayton. And I worked at a record store, and she got a job offer in Dallas, Texas, to go to work for a mercantile bank.
Right.
And so she flew down to Dallas and got the job and moved down there. And then a month later, I moved down, and I was thinking, man, you know, here's a brand new start. You know, and I'd done tons of rock and roll clubs, and I'd done some strip clubs as an MC doing comedy in between the girls.
Sure.
And so I had some background, and I thought, you know, here's my chance. So I went around Dallas, and I didn't tell anybody who I was. I just went and watched. And back then it was things like I saw Bully and Wilson.
Of course.
And they had their own nightclub, and I went to a lot of different places in Dallas. And when I got back, I was sitting down making a list and notes of what I'd seen when I was there. And my wife said, "Well, you know what? You ought to just start at the top, pick the one you want to do the most, and if they tell you no, you can always step down to smaller clubs." And I said, well, there's this place called the Palladium on Northwest Highway. And wow, what a showroom, you know. Uh-huh. And it used to be an old dinner theater. And I said, it's huge.
Windmill
I'd love
dinner
to do
theater.
It.
Yeah, the old windmill.
So I go in, and if my memory serves me correct, it might have been Danny Eaton himself.
Uh-huh.
And I went in, and the little girl at the ticket office said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm here to talk about booking an act. And she said, well, he's here. I'll see if he can talk to you. So I walk in the office, and I said, I'd like to talk to you about booking an act. And he said, what's the name of your band? And I said, well, it's not a band. It's a stand-up comedian impressionist. And he said, well, we're a music venue. We don't really book comics. And I said, well, you'd book this guy because he cut his teeth playing rock and roll clubs. And he said, do you have any videotape? And I said, you want the big 2-inch? You want Beta? You want VHS? I got them all right here in my briefcase. And he said, follow me. So he takes me down into the ballroom. It's daytime, but it's dark as a coal mine in there, you know?
Sure.
And hits this button, and this huge screen comes down out of the ceiling. He said, give me a VHS tape. So I gave him a VHS tape that I'd had. And we sit there, and it was only like 2 minutes long, a demo tape. And he was laughing, and he said, this is fine. He said, that's great. So when it's over, he says, let's go on back up to the office. So we go up to the office, and in the video, I had a perm in my hair, so I had this big Brillo-headed hairdo, and I had since cut it off. So I had short hair and straight hair, and we walked into the office in the daylight, and he goes, you look a lot like this guy. Is this your brother? And I said, no, it's me. And he said, well, I got a good show coming up, and I could really use a comic in between. He said, I've got Wet Willie as the headliner, and a local guy, you don't know him, Bugs Henderson. And I said, Bugs Henderson, who played with Nitzinger? And he said, I thought you were from Indiana. And I said, I am, but I'm a big Nitzinger fan. And I said, I'd love to do this show. So Bugs went on first, I went on in between, and then Wet Willie, and everything was great.
Uh-huh.
So about, I don't know, maybe a week or two went by, and I had some gigs up in Indiana and Ohio, so I flew back to the Midwest and did my shows, and when I came back, the Palladium had closed.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm telling you, Paul, I was so bummed out. And so I was looking for some extra gigs, and I was going around to some open mic nights, and I hear an Agora Ballroom is opening up where the Palladium was. And I'd heard about the Agora Ballrooms growing up in the Midwest because they had a Cleveland club and an Akron Canton club.
Okay.
And so I was real excited about it, and I went and I met with Eddie Gaddis, and the next thing you know, I'm playing the Agora opening shows.
Oh, man.
From that, Louis Messina and Stevie Hauser from Pace Concerts booked a lot of acts for the Agora, and they were in the audience one night, and I don't even remember who I was opening for, but they loved my act, and so they started getting me gigs. So I ended up playing the South Park Meadows in Austin. I ended up playing the Summit in Houston. I played the Last Stop in Houston, and I played the Last Stop in Austin. And I started getting all these gigs, and over the time, because I was doing so well, Angus Wynn had seen my show, and Angus, what a great guy. He kind of took me under his wing and said, you know, hey, I got shows you can open. They're not as big as the Agora Ballroom, but, you know, I can get you some good money.
Uh-huh.
And so he got me booked at the Knicks Uptown, and Pace was booking acts like, you know, they were booking acts that were up and coming, you know, Quarter Flash and Eddie Money and acts like that, whereas Angus was booking a little more eclectic acts, like jazz and blues and stuff at Knicks.
Mm-hmm.
So between those guys, between Pace Concerts and Angus Wynn, I got a lot of work. It was great. And, you know, I was just I was just really hitting my stride, and Dallas was really happening at the time.
Oh, it really was, yeah. Who were some of the other acts that you opened for at the Agora?
Well, at the Agora, I opened up for Todd Rundgren and Utopia, the Clark Duke Project, the Temptations, John Lee Hooker, Elvin Bishop, the Plasmatics, King Crimson,
wow,
Leon Russell, Levon Helm, and the Muscle Shoals All Stars, Nicolette Larson, John Lupani, Steve Hackett, Chick Corea, Doc Severinsen, all kinds of acts. And then at the Knicks, I was opening for acts like Angela Bofill and Herbie Hancock and Don McLean and acts like that.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
You've heard of him? John Prine and Eric Johnson and... What happened, this is kind of an interesting thing. I got booked to open for John Lupanti at the Agora Ballroom.
Right.
And I had never played parties. And I got a call from their guy, and I forget who that was. But Cardi's called me and said, hey, we'd like you to open for Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe, Rockpile. And I said, oh, that'd be great. And they told me the date, and it was the same night as John Lupanti. And I said, oh, wouldn't you know it? I said, I booked the Agora that night. And he said, well, what time do you go on? And I said, well, it's an early show, 7 or 7:30. And he said, well, we're not going to put Dave Edmonds on until later, so you could open up here at 9, couldn't you? And I said, yeah. And I got to open both shows the same night. And the next day in the Dallas Morning News, it talked about how I had opened up for both shows on the same night.
That doesn't happen often.
No, I mean, I saved the newspaper clipping, and it's one of the happiest memories I ever had. And like I say, from the Agora and Knicks and Louis Messina and Angus, these things came out of the woodwork. I got called to open for Willie Nelson at Billy Bob's. And I got called to open for Emmylou Harris at the Longhorn Ballroom.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was just incredible. Once it started going, bam, Dallas really kicked off my comedy career. And I would say the peak of it was in 1982. Pace had booked Chicago's first three cities of their comeback tour. Chicago hadn't done much of anything except some casinos and things like that. And then in 82, they were coming out with Chicago 16 and a new record label, new producer, and they were real excited. And it was the Chicago comeback tour. And it was two shows in New Orleans at the Sanger Theater, and then two shows in Houston, and then two shows at Fair Park in Dallas. So I was doing six shows, opening for Chicago, and being from Indiana, my gosh, you know, Chicago were heroes of mine.
Oh, yeah.
I was elated to be picked to open for them. So, and it would end in Dallas, and I'd be back home. So I thought, great, you know. And I go out and I do the shows, and work. The first show at Fair Park, my wife and friends had came, and in between shows, we, you know, talked backstage, and they left. And I did the second show, and after the second show was over, I hung around to say goodbye to Chicago and everything, and I went into the manager's office, and I said, look, if you ever need a comic impressionist to open for Chicago again, please make it me. This was such a thrill for me. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you got about 2 hours and 30 minutes. And I said, what? And he said, well, that's about how long it's going to take to get everybody, get everything loaded and the trucks ready and the buses ready. You want to do the rest of the whole tour? And I said, well, and Robert Lamb and Peter Cetera were around the corner, and they stuck their head in the office and said, come on, kid, go with us. And bam, off I went. And I ended up doing 82, 83, 84, and 85 until April.
Wow.
with Chicago, and wow, what a whirlwind that was. We played all over the U.S. and Canada.
Well, what was your opening act for them? Was it almost pure comedy? Did you do impersonations or what?
Yeah, I was doing stand-up comedy with impressions, and I kind of geared it to the, you know, quote, hippie crowd, because most of their fans at the time were, you know, older. They were my age and older, most of them. They had a few younger fans, and there was a lot of women in the audience. So I just I did impressions and comedy that and geared it to that mindset and that genre, and it worked out great. I had a wonderful time.
Wow. Oh my gosh. So tell me what. So you were with them till what, 86?
I was with them from 1982 until April of 85. And how that happened was, at the end of 82, Jack Gowdy, who was their tour manager, said to me, you know, we appreciate it, and we're getting ready to do another album. And I said, are they going to keep me on? And he said, well, Alan, normally, you know, they don't use the same opening act for a whole tour. And you did all of 82, and he said, we're going back to a lot of the same areas, and he said, you know, I'll see if I can find you something else, but Chicago's probably not going to, you know, they've used you for a whole year. So I went back to the house, you know, kind of disheartened and everything, and they had decided to use Brad Garrett as their opening act, and his manager had sent them a bunch of clips, video clips of him guesting on TV shows, on sitcoms, and he did really well. So they thought, well, he'll be great. So they start the 83 tour, and I'm back. I've already booked some comedy clubs, so I'm back doing clubs. And seven or eight nights into the tour, every night I would come home and I'd go, well, they're in Cleveland tonight, or they're in so and so tonight. Here I am in the clubs. What am I going to do? And I get a phone call about 11 o'clock at night. And it's Jack Gowdy, the road manager. And he said, hey, man, this Brad Garrett guy isn't working out. He said, 2 nights ago at Chastain Park in Atlanta, where you got a standing ovation, they were throwing cups of beer at him. and he said, his style is just not working for the big stage. And he said,
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, you guys are about as 180 as there is in comedy.
Yeah, and he said they wanted to get rid of him the second night, but they had a contract. And so we called the main office in L.A., and they've got us out of the contract. And he said, long story short, if you want to do all 83 tour, we got a round trip ticket waiting for you at DFW Airport tomorrow, and you'll fly out and meet us in Cleveland for Blossom Music Festival venue, and we'll give you a raise. So I got to do all 83. So then in 84, same thing, you know, hey, you've toured with us 2 years, and we don't use an act the whole year, but they had decided to use a band called Big Country.
Oh, yeah.
They had a hit, and so and they had some dates with Nicolette Larson, I think, and so that was set. And I thought, well, you know, here we go back to the clubs again, and the exact same thing happened. A week into it, I get a call late night. They said, hey, this act is too incongruous with what Chicago plays. They're charging way too much money for an opening act and this, that, and the other. And long story short, you want to do 84. We'll give you a raise, and we got a round trip ticket waiting for you at DFW tomorrow morning. And so out I went. Well, in 84, Peter Cetera had said to the band that he wanted to do some solo things, and he was married and had a little girl, and he had this beautiful home in Idaho, and he just wanted to get off the road. And they talked him into staying.
My name is Paul Heckman. I am the Executive Director of Memories Incorporated, an IRS-approved 501c3 nonprofit. A few years ago, we saw a niche for Facebook pages free of politics and created our first page, Memories of Dallas, which is now well over 30,000 members strong. We have expanded our Facebook pages to include Memories of Texas, Memories of Texas Football, and Memories of Texas Music. We also have actual web pages for memoriesofdallas.org, memoriesoftexas.org, memoriesoftexasfootball.org, and meminc.org, our mothership. We are working on additional web pages now. Please come see us.
Are you looking for a podcast network that talks Texas by Texans? Well, check us out. You're already listening to us, but go to the website, LoneStarPodcast.com. You can also find us on every big podcast platform, LSPN. We have shows in business, entertainment, marketing, music, of course, sports. We have some of the best sports podcasts in the state of Texas, ranging from high school football all the way up to pro basketball. So check us out online, LoneStarPodcast.com. That's the LSPN on every major podcast platform.
He just wanted to get off the road, and they talked him into staying, and he said, well, I'll stay until spring of 85 then, because Chicago 17 was a big hit. And when I first started touring with Chicago, we were doing 2,000 to 5,000 seaters, and we were not selling them out. Some cities, 2 shows a night. And as Chicago 16 grew, bam, we were doing 10,000 seaters and selling them out. Uh-huh. And then Chicago 17 hit, and we were playing huge venues in the round.
Oh, wow.
Sold out. So it was incredible. And the management of Chicago and most of the members of Chicago wanted to keep touring off the success of those 2 albums back-to-back, having so many hit singles. Uh-huh. And Peter just didn't want to do it. So Peter was leaving in April of 85, and they were going to take a break and try to work somebody new in. So in April of 85, that was my last touring with them full-time. However, in 87 and 89, they had some open dates, and I got a call from their management, and I went out and did some one-offs or like 3 cities and then back home, not a full tour. And so that was very instrumental in building my comedic career.
Sure. So what happens next?
Well, I went back to the comedy clubs, and by this time, the comedy clubs were starting to die out. I mean, it was a big thing in the 80s, but in the mid to late 80s, you know, they were starting to, you know, become old hat, and now you had all these TV shows with comics on it, you know, Stand Up Live and Live from the Improv and all this kind of stuff. So the comedy clubs were kind of dying out, and I was wondering, you know, what's my next move? And in 87, I went to do a comedy club in Dayton, Ohio, and in the audience was a guy that I'd done radio with in Kokomo, Indiana, when I first got into radio. He came to the show with his general manager, and they said, hey, look, how would you feel about getting off the road and becoming Dr. Dave's morning show partner on Z93 in Dayton, Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, and he wrote down a number on a napkin and slid it across to me, and he said, we'd start you at that a year. All your commercials on the side with your voices would be paid extra. Live performances paid extra. And we'll pay for your move. We'll set you up in a house here. And my wife was expecting our second daughter in February, and this was November. This was October. And he said, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield, 401k, and I went, fine. And I'd done radio when I was not on the road with Spyro Gyra and Chicago and different ones. When I come back to Dallas, I was doing commercials for the Agora Ballroom, doing commercials for Better Rest Waterbeds, and a lot of clients in Dallas using my impressions and my voices.
Sure.
So I already had this radio experience, and I was kind of like the third silent member of Bo and Jim's morning show on Q102. And so I had this radio experience, and I said, well, okay, you know, I'm going to do this because with the kid coming, it'll all be paid for with the insurance and this, that, and the other, and I'll try it. And I said, well, I got comedy gigs coming up, and when I clean those out, I'll fly back. And they said, oh, no, you got to start Monday.
Oh, no.
So I called my wife in Dallas, and I said, put the house up for sale. I'm going to be doing mornings on Dayton Radio. And she was elated because she was from Eaton, Ohio, which is just about 40 minutes from Dayton. Oh. And I got into morning radio is what I did. Oh. And I did that from 87 until right before 90. The radio station had changed management, and they were trying to breach my contract, and I had to take them to court. And it took me a year to get them to court, and the court lasted every day for a week, and the jury found in my favor. So I was paid a great settlement.
Uh-huh.
And I went down to Cincinnati and did radio for WKRQ. They told me when they hired me, they said, we have another radio team coming in to do our morning show, but they're under a no-compete for 6 months, so can we sign you up for 8 to 9 months? And I said, sure. So I did morning radio in Cincinnati, and then when that was over, I went back to doing stand-up comedy. And I came back to Indiana and bought a farm and was out on the road doing comedy. And I got a call from the...
Wait a minute. You said you bought a farm?
Yeah, I bought a farm.
And what was on this farm? I've got to hear this.
Well, it was just 7 acres of land, a big barn, and an old farmhouse, and I had farmers all around me, corn growing right up to my property,
uh-huh.
And so my kids got into 4-H, and my wife was into horses, and we bought some horses, and I got a job doing morning radio on the very radio station that I'd worked at as a young kid.
Oh my gosh. I'm probably one of the few people.
Morning radio there, and it was just so lackluster because it was a much smaller market. I mean, Dallas is a top 3 and Dayton is a top 40 market.
Sure.
And here I was in like market 159 or something. So I told him, I said, there's going to have to be changes in the morning show or I'm going to put my notice in.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave them 3 months to make the changes, and they claimed they couldn't do it. So I walked,
uh-huh.
And the guy that had done sound for Chicago owned a complex in North Hollywood called Third Encore Studios, and mm-hmm. It was rehearsal studios. It was Cartage delivering gear and renting gear, and they had several offices there. Yamaha had an office. Gibson had an office. Orange had an office, all these equipment people, and they had huge storage lockers for bands like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Los Lobos, and Yanni, and Tom Petty, and all these people, Ozzy. So he said, look, I'm going to the Ukraine for 3 months, and I need somebody to manage Third Encore Studios. And I said, oh my God, Bob, I don't know anything about that. And he said, come out for a week and I'll show you everything you need to know. And he said, you're a great people person, and that's what we need. He said, I got secretaries, I got technicians, I got everything you need. You'll just be running things and reporting to me once every other day.
Uh-huh.
So I would have to go out there for 3 weeks and home for a week, and out there for 3 weeks and home for a week. And during that time, my wife filed for divorce.
Oh, boy.
So I came back to Indiana and left the job there in California and came home and had no job and had no family. And I was pretty depressed. And for about 2 years, I just kind of hung out. I was emotionally crippled from it. I didn't know what my next move would be. I felt like I'd never be funny again. I would never sing or perform again. And I was trying to wonder what I wanted to do. So I went to work for my cousin's restaurant and fried hamburgers. And
there you go. Just
kind of melded into the fabric.
Whatever works. Yeah.
And after a couple of years, that was in 97, my divorce was final. And so for about 2 or 3 years, I just kind of floated. And then I started getting the itch again. I'd go out and see a comic, or I'd go out and see a band, and I'd think, God, I can do better than that. What am I doing frying burgers? So, you know, I gotta go do something. So I started looking for some gigs, and I called a friend of mine, Larry Smith, who, by the way, worked at Performance Magazine in Texas.
Mm.
And he had left Texas and went to Nashville and started the Talent and Touring Booking Guide. And I called him up and I said, you know everybody. I need some gigs. And in the meantime, I had went to a Halloween party dressed as Ozzy Osbourne. And it was a really cheap put-together costume and a fake Halloween store wig and, some plastic crosses. And it was just really, really shoddy costume, but I stayed in character the whole time. And some people filmed it, and I sent it to Larry in Nashville. And he said, my God, I thought I was looking at Ozzy Osbourne. That is incredible. Why you're looking for gigs? Why aren't you in the tribute business? And I said, Larry, I know absolutely nothing about the tribute business. And he said, well, if I got you an audition, would you go? And I said, well, absolutely. So he calls me back a couple days later, and he said, Legends in Concert is the biggest tribute business in the country. They have a place in Nevada, Las Vegas. They have a place in Atlantic City. They have a place in Myrtle Beach, Carolina. He said they got a place in Branson. He said that they want you to come out and audition as Ozzy Osbourne and as Joe Cocker.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay. So I went out and...
Now you had done Joe Cocker before at this time, right?
Well, I had never done a tribute to him, but when I sang in bands in between doing comedy, I would do singing impressions, and one of them was Joe Cocker.
Okay.
And people loved it. I mean, they loved it. So I thought, well, those are the two that I could do the best. So I went out, flew out to Las Vegas, and I got to the hotel, and I was supposed to audition the next day at 4 in the afternoon. And so I messed around and called some friends I knew in Vegas and did this and that, and I went to bed, and at 8:30 in the morning my phone rings at the hotel room, and it's Legends in Concert, and she said, our CEO, we're building a new theater in at the Hollywood Casino, at the Hard Rock Casino in Hollywood, Florida, and he has to fly out to that venue to see how the theater's coming, and we were wondering if we could do the audition this morning. And I said, and my voice is all croaky. I'm laying in bed in a hotel, and it's like 8:30 in the morning. And she said, "Could you be here by 10 o'clock?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Okay, see you then." Click. And I'm thinking, "Oh my God!" So I gather up this stuff and I put it in my bag, and I get a cab, and I go, and I get there, and it's a beautiful office, huge, and on the wall, there are like 7-foot by 4-foot posters of people that they have that impersonate people. They had a guy doing Buddy Holly, and he's on the wall. They had a guy doing Tom Jones, and he's on the wall, and the girl doing Tina Turner, and all these huge, beautiful full-color posters framed in this huge office. And they take me down the hall and said, okay, here's a dressing room, and when you're done, we're going to bring you to this room and across the hall, and you're gonna do Joe Cocker first and then Ozzy. And I said, okay. So I go in, and I had this fake beard that I put on, and this fake wig, and a tie-dye t-shirt, and bell-bottom jeans, and cowboy boots, like the young Joe Cocker.
Okay.
And I had a CD with the music on it. So I go in, I get all this garb on as Cocker, and I tell them I'm ready. And so they walk me into this room, and now you got to imagine, now this is 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a room that's probably 30 feet by 25 feet. It's the whole ceiling is fluorescent lights. It's lit up like an operating room. In the back of the room, there is a soundboard. there are two PA cabinets on either side of a stage that is only 6 inches tall, and one mic, and in the back of the room there's a guy with a video camera and a soundboard, and there are six beige metal folding chairs with three office girls and four or five men sitting there with their arms folded like, okay, impress me. And the guy said, state your name for the camera. And I said, I'm Alan Kay. And he said, where are you from? And I said, Kokomo, Indiana. And he said, who are you doing? And I said, Joe Cocker. And he said, anytime you're ready. And so they start the CD, and I do my Joe Cocker. I get done, and they applaud politely.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we understand you're going to do Ozzy for us. And I said, yeah. And he said, how long will it take you? And I said, well, I got to get this stuff off and the Ozzy stuff on. I said, 20 minutes? And they said, fine. Everybody meet back here in 20 minutes. So I left my dressing room door open a crack. So as I'm taking off the Cocker and then putting on the Ozzy, I can see through the crack. And when all of them were assembled back into the room, I had an intercom thing, and I said, "Could you get ready? Because I'll be in there in just a minute." And so they're all just kind of milling around, and I just busted the door open and went, "Hey! I'm supposed to do an audition here. Please, love. Could I have a microphone, please?" And they just went crazy laughing, and I just went into this whole thing about I'm trying to get in shape to do my chore, so I need to lose a little weight, and I borrowed three of Sharon's diet pills, and I took them, and it didn't turn out well, man, because at 3 o'clock in the morning I had this brilliant idea to redo the bathroom. So I tore out the toilet, I moved the tub, it was a disaster, man. The people at the Holiday Inn said, Ozzy Osbourne, you'll never stay here in our hotels again, mate.
Oh, no.
And they go, you're hired. Go take your stuff off and come up to the main office. So I take the stuff off and I go up to the main office, and the guy shows me this beautiful model. It's set up on an 8-foot table. It's an architectural model of the theater they're building at the Hard Rock Cafe in Hollywood, Florida.
Uh-huh.
Unbelievable detail. And he said, This will be open in February, and we want to hire you for 6 weeks. And I said, great. So I came back, and February was approaching, and I heard nothing from Legends. And so February gets here, and I call out to Legends, and I said, I need to speak to CEO. This is Alan Kay, who does Ozzy Osbourne, and da-da-da-da-da. And they put me in contact with him, and he said, we've had a hurricane down here, and we can't get the steel in to build the theater. So it's probably going to be March or April. So sure enough, in March or April, they called me and said, you got the gig. And I went down and did Ozzy Osbourne 6 days a week in the hot Florida sun with a wig and black clothes. And I had a wardrobe put together. And when I got there, they took me into a beauty shop that was there on the Hard Rock property. And they had a human hair wig for me that was so incredibly real, you could stand right up against it and you wouldn't know it was a wig.
Wow.
And they started cutting it to the Ozzy. So I'm dressed as Ozzy, I've got this wig on, and I'm sitting in this barber chair, and this beautician is cutting this wig. And she goes, oh my God, look outside the window. And there must have been 50 people with cameras and phones pressed up against the window, convinced that Ozzy Osbourne was in there getting a haircut.
And he was.
And he was.
He was.
So the CEO and the president said,
oh my God,
let's walk you through the casino just for the fun of it. So after they get the haircut, they take me out a back door, and they take me to the casino, and I'm walking through the Hard Rock Casino, which from time to time has the real stars walking around and hanging.
Sure.
The CEO and the president are walking like 25 feet behind me, and they've got two security guys on either side of me going, excuse me, moving people out of the aisles. And the place is packed. I mean, packed. And they're walking me down through this, and everybody's going, oh, my God, it's Ozzy Osbourne. You know, and I'm walking through there, and they're standing behind, 20 feet behind, laughing their butt off.
Sure.
And I get up to the place to turn, and this girl says, are you the real Ozzy Osbourne? Knowing that that's a no-no, I looked at her and I said, who do you think it is, love? Who else would be dressed like this? Father Christmas. And she goes, oh, my God, it is you. Can I have a picture? And I said, sure, love, come here. And all these people I stood there for probably 30 minutes taking pictures, and finally I said, okay, Ozzy's got to go, and they rushed me out of there. And when I got back to the theater, the mm-hmm. president told me, he said, nobody at the Hard Rock Casino knew it wasn't Ozzy but us. They had security guys walking 20 feet in front of me, moving people out of the aisle. Go set it at the slot machine or something. Don't get near him. This is Ozzy. Don't, please. No autographs, no bugging him.
Oh no.
So I decided that I was going to do Ozzy Osbourne back in Indiana. And when I got back to Indiana, I had some friends got together, and they introduced me to some other musicians, and we put together a band, and it was going to happen. And all of a sudden, the Osbourne reality show quit running, and Sharon's talk show tanked.
Mm-hmm.
So the calls for Ozzy Osbourne just dried up.
Oh, wow.
And I thought to myself, if you look like an artist but don't sound like him, you make money for going to conventions and letting people have their picture taken with you and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
If you sound like them but don't look like them, you make some money but not that much.
Mm-hmm.
The key in the tribute business is not only to look like them but to sound like them both, and I thought I could do Joe Cocker.
Mm.
So I had a guy that does Barry White for Legends in Concert teach me how to make a beard, a real, real, real looking beard. And I did it, and so I went to a guy, I'd made friends with a guy at the Hard Rock Casino who portrays Tom Jones. His name is Steve McCoy, and he runs this company called The Real McCoy LLC in Vegas. And he not only performs as Tom Jones, he puts together shows for all over the country of mm-hmm. tribute act.
Right.
And what it consists of is a 7-piece band, and then each artist character brings their charts. And you rehearse in the afternoon, and then you do the shows at night. And he had a Rod Stewart and an Elton John and a Tina Turner and Aretha Franklin. He's got all these A++ people that I've gotten to work with over the years. And I went and I showed him a video. What I did was I was sitting outside a theater, and he had a cassette player in his car, and I said, I want you to listen to a cassette, Steve. And he said, okay. So I played it, and played a little bit of it, and he goes, oh, I know who that is. That's Joe Cocker. I'm a big Joe Cocker fan. And I said, okay. And I ran it up to the next song and played a little bit, and he goes, I know this album. I've got this album. I said, no, you don't have this album, Steve. He goes, I do. I go, wait a minute. And I run it up to the next song. And he goes, look, I'm a huge Cocker fan. I got all his albums and stuff. I know who this is. And I said, no, you don't. This is me. And he said, no, it's not. And I said, it's me. And I said, here, I want you to see this videotape. So I show him the videotape, and he said, can I be honest with you? And I said, please do. And he said, well, your Ozzy Osbourne is incredible. And he said, your Joe Cocker voice-wise is incredible. But he said, with that beard and that fake wig, and he said, you look like a Halloween costume. Sorry. And he said, why don't you just cut your hair really short and grow your own stubble? Joe's gray now. And just do it like that. And I said, oh, people will never believe it. And I fought him on this for months. He would call me and go, come on, do it. And I said, and to tell you the truth, Paul, the wig and the fake beard was like a security blanket to me. and I wouldn't let go of it. And finally he said, look, I think I can get you some work as Joe Cocker. If you'll just do it the way I want to, will you please, for me, try it. And I said, sure. And he said, well, I've got a show down in Cincinnati. And he said, actually, it's in Kentucky, right across the river from Cincinnati. And he said, I want you to come and do a guest set. And he said, do it with just you and just prove me right or prove me wrong. So I said, okay. So I grew the stubble out. And I went to my barber and I had him shave my head practically, do the Joe Cocker cut, and I put a gap in between my front teeth. And I got some blue contacts from my eye doctor, and I got an all black suit because the last couple decades of Joe Cocker, he used to perform in a lot of different things, but then he got to where he wore all black shirt, a black suit, black shoes.
I remember.
And so I did that. And I went and did it, and it killed. And so that started me out doing the Joe Cocker tribute. And so when I came back to Indiana, I got the guys together, and I said, look, we need to learn these Cocker songs. And so we formed this Cocker tribute. Well, in the tribute world, your big names are like, the most requested are like Elvis or Tina Turner or the Blues Brothers, those types of acts. Led Zeppelin tribute, Beatles and Stones tributes. And Joe Cocker's way down on the list. So I wasn't getting that many Cocker gigs. And so the band said to me, look, why don't we form a covers band, and we'll do the covers band, and we'll rotate Cocker songs in and out of our sets, so that when we do get a Cocker gig, we don't have to woodshed to relearn songs we haven't played in 4 to 6 months. And I said, great. And I said, the only thing is, I want it to be a true band, a democracy. Everybody has one vote. I don't want to run it. I have to run the Cocker show, and I don't want to run a cover band. And they said, okay. So they're all from Indianapolis, and they know the Indianapolis club scene, so they had a lot of connections. And I got a call to go do Ozzy Osbourne for a Oktoberfest in New Hampshire. And so I drove, I went to do this Ozzy Osbourne for a month at this amusement park. And I would do Ozzy as the MC of their other tribute acts. They had a Prince tribute act and a thing they called Mini Kiss. It was these little people who did dressed up like Kiss, and so they called it Mini Kiss.
Mini Kiss.
And like I say, they had a Madonna and several other tribute acts, and Ozzy was to be the MC. So I went to do that, and I was getting ready to come back to Indiana, and we had our first gig as this new covers band. And I said, we took some pictures for publicity. We need a name for the band, and everybody had put in like three names. And one of the names that I'd put in was The Toons, T-O-O-N-S, like cartoons.
Sure.
So the week before I was to leave New Hampshire and come back, I called the lead guitar player, and John Dinwiddie, and I said, John, we've got pictures, but we got to have a name. And he goes, oh, well, we've already decided on a name. And I said, great, what is it? And he said, Alan Kay and The Toons. And I said, oh, I like that, but I put The Toons in. It was one of my names. And I said, but let's just call it The Toons. And he said, no, everybody knows you from doing your comedy and your impressions and stuff. And he said, it's going to be Alan Kay and The Toons. And I said, well, I don't really want to do it that way. And he said, you said you wanted a true democracy? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, we voted on it last week. It's going to be Alan Kay and The Toons. So, Alan Kay and the Toons was born. So,
oh my gosh.
That's what I'm basically doing now. I'm doing Alan Kay and the Toons, and then every so often, when we get the Cocker tribute gigs, I go ahead and cut my hair and grow the stubble, and we go out and do Cocker for a while, and then come back and do Alan Kay and the Toons.
The last time I saw you was 2019, and you get a call from Angus, and you're opening the 2019 50th anniversary reunion of the 1969 festival. as Joe Cocker.
The 50th anniversary of the Texas International Pop Festival was a dream come true.
Oh, it was so fun. It was so fun.
I owe Angus such a great debt of thanks and gratitude because, you know, he made it all happen. And it was so nice to see Danny Eaton again. And it was a great honor to be on the same stage as John Mayall and
Carolyn Winterland
and ZZ Top.
Chicago was there the next night. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, and in between when I'm on stage as Cocker, I stay in character the whole time. When I'm on stage as Alan Kay and the Tunes, in between the songs, I do impressions and comedy bits. Uh-huh. So it makes me more of a front man than just a lead singer, which sets us apart from the bands in Indianapolis that are cover bands.
Sure. Well, listen, Alan, it's been so good talking to you, my friend. If you ever need anything or next time you stop in Dallas, you give me a call, okay?
I would be glad to. I'd love to hang out with you. Thank you for having me on the podcast call.
I'll grab Angus, by the way. I'll grab Angus, and we'll make him pay for lunch.
Continue the good work with Memories of Dallas. I see all these people participating and posting. I love seeing the memories of, you know, the places I played, you know, Cardiff and the Agora and the Knicks and everything, and seeing places that I ate, aw shucks, across the street from Knicks, and it's just great. I want to thank all the people that come on your site and participate and post posters and pictures and videos, and I want to encourage everybody to when you got a few bucks on the side that you can spare, make a donation to Paul Heckman and his organization, because it's the sites like this on Facebook that keep it alive. Your participation is appreciated, and I'm sure that your donations are more than welcome and appreciated. So let's keep it all going. And I just look back on those days of Dallas from 1980 to 1987 when I lived there as a very magic time, the Texas jams and all the great things that went on. And I want to say hello to all my friends that are listening to this podcast. And until we speak again, best of everything. Best of health and luck to everyone.
Thank you, my brother.
See ya.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, I want to thank Paul Heckman for sharing that meeting he had. As always, we have to thank our sponsors, Toothacres Pet Care Center. For all your boarding needs, choose Toothacres, because Toothacres cares. And I also want to thank you, the listener, for giving us your time and attention. Share these shows out on all your social media and help us preserve Memories of Dallas. Until next time, I'm your host, Chris Daly, reminding you that the best thing about memories is making them. So go out and make some memories.